is United States of America versus Stain. And Ms. Overmeyer, you're up.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Wendy Overmeyer for Edward Stain, and I reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, and I'll track my time. Today, we ask this court to clarify that legal changes, just like factual changes, can constitute extraordinary and compelling reasons for compassionate release. And from its inception, extraordinary and compelling reasons can result from changes in law, just like factual changes, that render particular sentences excessive. And the best source of this, there's a number of sources I plan to talk about today, but which are not by any means all-inclusive. The first is Congress itself, and looking at the original legislative history from the compassionate release statute passed in 1984. And that purpose was, quote, a safety valve, and to reduce, quote, unusually long sentences where there were changed circumstances.
Can I interrupt for a second? Let's assume for a moment that the district court erred in not finding the change in the sentencing scheme to be an extraordinary and compelling circumstance. How do you get past the district court's 3553 findings? Our cases say you have to satisfy both in order to be to get relief. They're not incredibly detailed, and they might have been done better, but our case law says we give a fair amount of deference to them. And this judge seems to say, you know, I think the sentence was appropriate.
Thank you, Your Honor. Yes, the alternative ruling that the district court made as to 3553 can't support denial alone. First of all, because it did not consider the changes themselves as a 3553A factor. And on this point, there is no circuit split. All of the circuits agree that whether or not they hold the changes can be extraordinary and compelling, they are to be considered as 3553A factors under a number of 3553A factors, which this court went through recently in Lizarraga's.
No, the judge didn't expressly discuss them, but the judge was surely aware of the change in law because he discusses it in the first part of the analysis and then gets to the second part and says, not in the world's most detailed fashion, to be sure, I don't think the 3553A factors call for a change in the sentence in light of the seriousness of the offense, et cetera. Why isn't that enough?
That's not enough, Your Honor, because the seriousness of the offense, yes, of course, is a 3553A factor, but that is essentially the only 3553A factor we can be assured that the district court looked at. And, you know, Stain did not dispute that these crimes are serious, but that the sentence still dramatically exceeds what Congress deems appropriate, particularly given his unique circumstances. And that's what the court failed to address in its order, that he's a first-time offender, that he has, you know, serves the sentence for the robberies completely. He has almost finished serving 7 years for the first 924C, and he has not committed any further violent acts in prison. He has family support. He was only 23 years old at the time of this offense, so he served almost half of his life in prison.
Can I take you back now to the first part of your argument? We've said, I think it's pretty clear, that you can't treat the guidelines commentary as binding because it was not revised after the relevant legislation. But we can say you can treat it as informing your decision. In this case, the judge seems to have recited the correct law. He says, you know, I know it's not binding, but the fact that it's not listed persuades me that I shouldn't regard it as a compelling decision. How do we review that? What's our standard of review?
Standard standard for review is to ensure the court applied the correct standard of law, which the district court here did cite to Arruda. But what the district court did, I'm sorry, I think my screen keeps freezing. I apologize.
We can see you fine.
Okay, good. What the district court did is very inconsistent, that the paragraph on ER5, which is page 4 of the judge's opinion, is quite inconsistent. While he doesn't hold the policy guideline as binding, he does misapprehend the breadth of that policy, first of all, and that it does include other reasons. And the Sentencing Commission left that flexible on purpose because, you can't predict what every single unique case will have. So he states twice that, non-retroactive changes are not listed. Well, of course, they are not specifically listed, but there is a general other reasons category. And the BOP, frankly, wrote out that category with its policy and never opens the gate under other reasons.
So one other question, and I guess it's a broad one. What do you want us to do? What relief are you seeking? Should we send this back to the district court if you prevail to do the correct analysis?
Yes. What we're asking is for this court to clarify that relevant changes in sentencing
law. No, I'm asking what the bottom line is. I'm asking what, if we were to rule in your favor, what would the big black... What would the black line at the bottom of the disposition say?
Yes, well, we would ask for a remand for a review on the complete merits, given this court's clarification that the changes in law can be a extraordinary and compelling circumstance and can be a 3553.
So this is a roundabout way of me getting back to the question I just asked you. You're not contending that the judge is compelled to find the change in law as an extraordinary and compelling circumstance, are you?
No, it's up to individual judges to find what's persuasive. But what's particularly necessary here is it's not just the change, the change won't be extraordinary and compelling in every case. But for Stain in particular, again, the unique circumstances of his case, the use of this as a trial tax, that he's a first-time offender, that he has proven rehabilitation, that he has no prison discipline.
This is why I'm asking the question. I'm trying to figure out what factors go into extraordinary and compelling circumstances and which factors go into the 3553A analysis. So in thinking, all these factors that you just recited, I guess you want the judge to consider twice, yes?
It is similar. It is similar. What Congress has held is there's one limit to extraordinary and compelling circumstances, and that's rehabilitation alone cannot be. Otherwise, it is open-ended. And the BOP, although they didn't include other reasons, they did include a list of factors in their policy to consider for extraordinary and compelling circumstances. And they're very similar to 3553. Those are at their policy 50.50. And they include things like, the age of the defendant at the time of sentencing, similar.
Well, counsel, if they're similar and the judge, it'd be one thing if this judge had just only had the first paragraph on ER5, right? But he has a second paragraph where he has this alternative holding. And if they're similar, like you're saying, and he did reach that conclusion, what makes you think that he would have reached a different conclusion on the extraordinary circumstance inquiry, given the conclusion that he reached when he actually considered the factors?
Well, it seems he misunderstood the breadth again of both inquiries, and so it's unclear what the court considered as far as the unique circumstances then. And
I'm not sure if I agree with you that he misunderstood, but even assuming that he misunderstood and he wasn't taking these other things into account in the first inquiry, my point is he did the factors inquiry and he reached a certain conclusion. I mean, do you think he would have, if he would have sort of imported those things into the first inquiry, it would have changed the conclusion when it didn't in his second one?
I think this what this court can't be assured of is that he did consider all of the relevant factors, the district court, because there's inadequate explanation that only addresses one factor as it existed, at, frankly, at the time of sentencing. There's nothing about the other changed factors, of which the First Step Act is just one.
Do you agree that we have case law that says that you don't have to expressly address every single factor, I think, right?
Right. You don't have to address every single factor. But in Cardi, this court did hold that when there are specific non-frivolous factors raised by the parties, the court should address why it accepts or rejects or finds them not persuasive or persuasive. And what we have here is so limited. I think I'd just like to point the court to the Jordan opinion on our reply brief at page 11, which is also the District of Nevada, that granted relief in a similar circumstance. That is, I think, an opinion that exemplifies the kind of analysis that assures this court that the changed circumstances were analyzed. Thank you.
Counselor, we've taken you over. I'll give you a minute for rebuttal later because we used up all your time. And we'll hear from the government.
Good morning. May it please the court. Adam Flake for the United States. I think our argument is that the district court did understand the legal framework in which it was operating, and it did properly exercise its discretion, both in finding a lack of extraordinary and compelling circumstances and in finding that the 3553A factors don't favor release.
Can we focus on the first part for a moment? I'm not sure I understand what the district court was saying. The court said, I know the guideline commentary is not binding on me. I know it can inform me, but I find it significant that it doesn't list a change in law as an extraordinary circumstance. And of course, that's one of the reasons we said it's not binding, because it was written before the change in the law. So didn't he really effectively say, I'm treating the absence of this language from the guideline commentary as precluding me finding an extraordinary and compelling circumstance?
I don't believe he did, Your Honor. I think that he understood that he was acting within his discretion in determining what constituted extraordinary and compelling circumstances. And he said, in this case, I'm not finding that the change in law did. He said, I think he followed Aruda, which says, you know, obviously the policy statement is no longer binding, but it can inform the district court's discretion. A case we cited in our brief from the Seventh Circuit called Gunn says the substantive aspects of the Sentencing Commission's analysis provide a working definition of extraordinary and compelling reasons. A judge who strikes off on a different path risks an appellate holding that judicial discretion has been abused.
Yeah, no, I understand that, but my problem is, as I read his decision, he effectively says the absence of this language from the commentary means that this isn't a compelling and extraordinary circumstance. And that, although he doesn't say I'm treating the guidelines as binding, isn't that effectively treating them as binding with respect to this factor?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because he tied it to his own discretion in this case. He said it in this case. I don't consider, he didn't say I'm forever precluded from finding that in any case. He said here, the change in law doesn't constitute an extraordinary circumstance. He said, I'm looking to the policy statement to inform that decision, but he never indicates that he didn't believe he had the discretion, if he had chosen to do so,
in that regard, what the district judge was talking about when he said that he was wary of expanding the definition of what constitutes an extraordinary circumstance. That sounds like a statement about the law as opposed to the facts that are right in front of him. Can you talk about that just a moment?
Well, again, Your Honor, he says that he's wary of it. He's disinclined to do it, but I don't think that he says anything that indicates that he can't. I don't think that he would have used that language if he felt like he could not do it. I think he understood the framework in which he was operating, and he simply tied it. Again, sorry to repeat myself, but he made it clear that he was exercising discretion in this case.
Well, he used the language. He said the court in the exercise of its discretion, but the label alone doesn't get me there, because the sentence before says there's a definition of extraordinary circumstances in the guidelines, and I don't find this there, and I'm wary. He doesn't say I'm precluded, but I'm wary of expanding that. So it does seem to me he treated the absence as a strong legal rule, keeping it out. And it seems to me it's one thing to say we look at these guidelines because they identify some good reasons and you can use them. But I'm not sure it's useful to look at the guidelines and say a reason that's not identified is one that I can't consider. So I raise that for you. I have some concerns with the first part, I guess, of the analysis.
Can I ask that? Because as I read the wary, I kind of have the view that I read this whole paragraph as this judge is disinclined to exercise his discretion to do this. And he's basically saying the guidelines don't address it, so that's good news to me because the guidelines don't make me do it, right? Like that's how I read it. If that's the correct reading, not that he feels like he's legally bound, because I think that's hard to read into this, but that he is sort of happy that he doesn't have to do it because the guidelines say he has to. Is that error for the judge to say, I'm disinclined to do this because he says I'm personally, you know, as a matter of my discretion, I personally as a judge am wary of expanding and sort of adding to the things that would cause extraordinary. I don't see where the guidelines make me do that, and so I'm not going to do it, quote, in my discretion. And so if that's what he's doing, is that error?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe that's error. I think that is the role of the district judge in this case. He's operating within the legal framework that he's given.
Does he have to say why he's? I mean, so he's obviously that would be exercising his discretion. But it kind of, if you read between the lines, it'd be I just personally don't want to expand what counts as an extraordinary circumstance. I don't see why I have to. Is that a legitimate reason, or is that not a legitimate reason for exercising his discretion?
Well, again, Your Honor, I think that if he understands the legal restraints under which he is operating, and he chooses to reach a decision within the bounds of the legal restraints imposed by the statute, then that is kind of the definition of an exercise of discretion.
Although we start from the premise here that after Arruda, the commentary in the guidelines is not binding in any respect. One can look at it and one can be informed by it, but one is not bound by it in any way. So if you start out with that, I think, unassailable proposition, I'd have some difficulty. If the judge had said, this is not in the guidelines, and in any event, I don't think in this case is a compelling circumstance, I'd be fine with that part. My problem is, and I can't tell, is the answer. I can't tell whether he's basically saying, it's not there and I don't think it's my job to expand the guidelines. And if he actually said that, then I would be more, and I think he did, I'm concerned about the first part. But I'd like you to deal with the 3553A question for a moment and start from the assumption that the judge does discuss the seriousness of the crime and whether the sentence fits the crime, but doesn't say much more. Is that enough? And if so, why?
I believe it is, Your Honor. And as the court correctly noted during my colleague's argument, the district court is not required to go through a checklist and tick off each of the 3553A factors. And it's certainly not required to count the number of factors that the number of factors that favor the defendant versus that do not favor the defendant. What the district court is required to do is weigh the factors, and the district court in this case weighed the factors, and it found that the extreme dangerousness of this defendant's conduct organizing three armed robberies, providing weapons, his co-defendants engaged in violent and threatening behavior, the court found that that egregious conduct simply weighed heavily in favor of maintaining the sentence. Of course, in every case when we are on appeal, we're going to wish.
Mr. Flake, was this the same judge who sentenced the defendant originally?
I believe so, Your Honor. Yes.
And was there a more thorough explanation of the judge's view of the defendant's dangerousness at the time of the initial sentencing?
There was, Your Honor, and I actually quoted a portion of it in my brief. The judge talked about watching the video and how horrific it was.
Is it,
they had some defendants that threatened a pregnant woman.
Yeah. Is it relevant that what, if anything, can we do on appeal in terms of recognizing that this judge has already expressed familiarity with the defendant? I believe there was a trial, and the judge previously expressed what must have been adequate, at least were not reversed on appeal, reasons for giving that sentence, even though the judge didn't refer back to that at this time. And then I have another question about the guidelines that I want to ask you too.
Certainly, Your Honor. And unfortunately, I wasn't able to find a case in this circuit that is particularly clear, but I cited a Sixth Circuit case that's name currently escapes me, that says the in addressing a compassionate release motion, this court can look at everything that the district court did, and it can consider the district court's findings of the original sentence in addressing whether or not the district court adequately understood. I mean, the point of all of this is to make sure that the district court understood the arguments that the parties are making, properly weighed the 3553A factors, and came to a decision that was within the scope of his discretion.
With your permission, just one.
Please.
Was there any dispute in front of the district court about the 319 month guideline sentence at this time? Are we to accept that was an accurate statement of the what would have been the current guideline?
There was no dispute, Your Honor. In fact, the district court well understood that. The district court actually explained that in its order denying compassionate release. The district court knew exactly what was going on. It explained the longer sentence, it explained the change in law, it explained the sentence that he would
right.
have received.
I know, but before a judge can exercise the 3553A factors, the judge has to accurately determine what the relevant guideline range that it's working with. And I just
right,
want to...
It did. And I don't think there's any dispute about that, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Other questions for the government? If not, we'll give you a minute for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. And I'm going to the court's belief that its discretion was somehow limited. I think Judge Erickson hit it right on the head with the line that it's wary of expanding what can constitute extraordinary. That shows the court believed that the definition of extraordinary was limited in a way that it is not. And so, because it misunderstood that standard, that would have to go back.
Can I ask you what I asked your opposing counsel, which is, if you read the wary as, I as a judge am personally wary of expanding it, the guidelines don't make me expand it, and I'm personally wary of doing that, and so I'm not going to, and I'm going to exercise my discretion not to do that. Is that, if you read it that way, is that impermissible somehow?
Yes, that is impermissible, especially here where the parties agreed that change was relevant to the court's consideration. And in general sentencing law, if a court disagrees with a particular relevant factor on a policy ground or because of the circumstances of the case, it must explain that on the record and not leave this court
so you know,
guessing.
If the judge had said, instead of what Judge Van Dyke just suggested, if the judge has said, I know the length of the sentence can be relevant to my determination of whether there are compelling and extraordinary circumstances, but in this case, I don't find it to be one in the exercise of my discretion, would that be sufficient?
I believe it would have to tie it to the particular circumstances of why this particular case doesn't. For instance,
if you said because the crime was so serious and people were injured and all the reasons that I said before, this is given the change in the law is not a compelling circumstance. You still got to get to the 3553A factors. I understand that, or maybe you don't. But what if he just said that? And didn't he effectively say that? I guess is my question. Given the later statement under 3553A factors that the crime was so serious that I'm not going to change the sentence?
I believe he did say the crime was serious, but not that it was so serious it warranted double what the 924C sentence would be today, 32 instead of 14. And for comparison,
he surely recognized that, as Judge Erickson pointed out, his order says, here's what the sentence would be today. Here's what the sentence was then. It's a big difference. He then says whatever he says about the guidelines and then goes on to say, but even if this wasn't a compelling circumstance, the seriousness of the crime really cuts against this. And I guess my question is, could he use the seriousness of the crime in determining whether or not the change in the law was a compelling circumstance? You seem to suggest before that he could, and if he could, then yes, he effectively has, hasn't he?
Well, he says the crime is serious, but not in what way that would warrant a more serious sentence than what Congress deems today. For instance, and Andrews, the case he cites, involved four 924C counts for discharge for shooting four people. And that still has a sentence of 40 years just on the 924C. So that case was very different than the circumstance here. And so without the court addressing what has happened today, it simply can't impart its original finding from the sentencing, 20 years ago to the change, both factual circumstances and the legal changes of what Congress and the commission have long urged to eliminate this punitive stacking.
We've taken you well over, but it's our fault, not yours. We appreciate your arguments and your briefing and those of the government, and this case will be submitted.
Thank you.